Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, Frank. Great to be with you.
Thank you so much. Let me start by asking you for a personal testimonial, if I could. You have literally run elections at both the state and federal level in the past. You understand the difference between voting arrangements that assure that only those entitled to vote are given an opportunity to do so, and how to make it as easy as possible for them to do it. We're hearing a lot about how Republicans are opposed to that, and that only the kind of sweeping changes that the Democrats are offering will, in fact, assure everybody's voting rights are respected. Talk to us about the ground truth here, if you would, sir.
Frank, let me just preface my remarks by saying that the greatest challenge we face in our 245th year as a constitutional republic is, do we have the moral courage and the political will to check the ever-increasing capacity for self-destruction? And what we've witnessed over the past several cycles of elections is that there is a growing lack of confidence in the integrity of the results of these elections, because voters have a greater sense that we've lost two important areas, or that at least we need to spruce up two important areas. One is the what I call the track of chain of custody, making sure that we have a tight chain of custody, that there's not a lot of time between when a voter cast the ballot and when it is counted, not too many hands touch that ballot, and that we have really focused on ballot security so that there's not an introduction of ballot insecurity and too many hands touching those ballots, that you ruin the chain of custody. The second is verification, making sure that voters are who they claim to be. And the most dominant fact here is that more and more voters have embraced the prudence of photo IDs for voters. Voters understand instinctively that one of the duties of citizenship, a lot of emphasis is placed on citizenship rights, but we also have duties of citizenship, and one of the duties is to make sure that we take the common sense precaution to make sure that voters are who they claim to be, and that's where photo IDs come into play. And so what we have seen is an assault by the left on the prudent and common sense reforms that are being taken place across the country. And Frank, I tell you, they have in fact talked about voter disenfranchisement, voter suppression, but they haven't made the case. They haven't showed the evidence that this is still playing. Rhetorically, they try to keep us locked into the 1960s and 1950s and Jim Crow. It is if, in fact, they are not only just stuck on stupid, they're frozen in a moment of history that the country has long passed because, you know, we saw great movement on making sure that access to the ballot box was secure for all legal voters, and so this assault is made up out of whole cloth.
Let me ask you about that legal voter business, because obviously that's really the cornerstone of free and fair elections that public can have confidence in, and yet, as you know, Mr. Ambassador, we're seeing in New York City at the moment, the new mayor and the city council there enacting legislation that would essentially enable anybody who has been in the city for 30 days to vote, illegal aliens or otherwise. And the question, I've talked with our colleague Hans von Spakovsky about this recently, and he said, well, you know, there isn't any way that that kind of illegal voting won't be integrated into the federal election system in that city, at least in the future, and perhaps become a template for similar kinds of fundamental transformation, as the Obama team likes to put it, of our voting system elsewhere across the country. Do you have that concern, sir?
Oh, I have that concern. The challenge for us is that what these folks will do is hide under the cover of home rule and say, well, you know, these folks are only going to vote on municipal issues. And because they work in the city, they should be able to vote on matters of municipal concern like local taxes. Well, Hans is right. This is going to bleed into the state then having to accept this. And once the state accepts it under the decentralized system that we have, we're going to see, I think, a constitutional bleeding out of our election system, which is problematic. But this shouldn't surprise us. You know, this clown car known as the Biden administration that has presented us with open borders, or a nation without borders, they, in fact, now are pushing a system and they're advocating for voters without borders. So it's part of the same blanket of incompetence that has produced, you know, soaring inflation, out of control gas prices, a devastating supply chain crisis, and again, wide open southern borders and status mandates associated with masks and vaccines, so-called vaccines, that should be really disquieting to voters. I think it was Thomas Paine who said it, Frank, that those who expect to reap the benefits of freedom, the blessings of freedom, must undergo the fatigue of supporting it. And that tied right into what Ronald Reagan used to tell us, you know, and that is that freedom is a fragile thing and it's never more than one generation away and that from extinction, and it is not ours by inheritance. We must fight for it and defend it constantly. And that's where we are now with this assault on the integrity of our election system.
Let me just say, as an aside, my own feeling about this is it's not just a clown car, as you call it, or incompetence. I think this is a wrecking operation. I think this is deliberate, and it's purposeful, and it's systematic, and really across the board, as you say. But just to come to the assault on election integrity at the moment, give us a quick update, if you would, on the status of the legislative efforts that have been now approved in the House of Representatives under Nancy Pelosi, I think on a straight party line vote, if I'm not mistaken, and that are now awaiting action in the United States Senate. What do you think is likely to happen in the Senate at the moment? And will the filibuster, vehicle for protecting minority rights in the Senate, be essentially thrown under the bus in the process?
Well, you know, Frank, I'm of that old school. It ain't over till it's over. And we have to keep pressing ahead. Right now, we have the votes to protect the filibuster. Right now, this assault on election integrity through the Freedom to Vote Act, or what I call, and a number of us call, the Freedom to Cheat Act, will be defeated. And this is just another chapter in what you just described as the intentional effort to fundamentally transform our constitutional republic into a welfare state, not unlike a state governance of other Marxists and communists and socialist things, right?
Yeah. You mentioned the Freedom to Vote Act or Freedom to Cheat Act. I think you're right. It's more accurately described as. The other piece of legislation that is being bruited and may get a vote here in the next few days as well is something called the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. What is that about, and how does that relate to this other legislative initiative, sir?
Well, look, the real difference between the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the Freedom to Vote Act is that the Freedom to Vote Act has the strong support of Joe Manchin, even though he says he won't mess with the filibuster to pass it. The real difference, Frank, is that the John Lewis John Lewis Voting Rights Act is 800 pages, and the Freedom to Vote Act, the Freedom to Cheat Act, is 500 pages. It is just as lethal, just as destructive, as you have underscored, as the Lewis Act. So, the Lewis Act will let them try to leverage sentimentality around the civil rights movement. But look, one of the things that we know is that we have to push these guys, and I think we have the senators that will do it, is show us the data, show us the evidence that voter disenfranchisement is taking place. They can't do it. Because whether it's the Brennan Center or any other center, here's the reality, Frank. We had the greatest level of voter participation in our history this last election. Secondly, there were a higher percentage of African American and minority voters than voters in general that participated. There is not disenfranchisement. And what they can't deal with is the fact that common sense reforms being enacted in the state to secure election integrity are warmly and widely embraced by minority voters.
American people more generally.
Right. Absolutely.
And on that, Ken Blackwell, the states have, by and large, not all of them, but many of them adopted voter ID, as you say, as part of their verification procedures. I was very interested. You mentioned the Brennan Center. The Brennan Center is, I believe, at NYU, and it has been a vehicle for leftist agitation on voting and a lot of other issues besides. But in an interview with its director this morning, National Public Radio's host made an observation that a recent study had found that voter IDs and I think some reasonable restrictions on mail-in balloting as well to try to minimize the chances that that will be, as it's often been recognized as, including by Jimmy Carter, and Jim Baker in a bipartisan study of the matter, as a vehicle for fraud, if you're not careful. He said that there's been recent research indicating neither of these arrangements materially impede voting or access to the vote for those who wish to do so and can do so legally. Is that your experience as well, Ken Blackwell, particularly as Secretary of State?
Oh, it's my experience. But Frank, let me put it in a broader context. I co-chair the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. This is a strictly bipartisan organization. We don't do domestic elections, but we do elections, help and advise in elections all across the globe. There's not another country in the world, that uses mail-in balloting or voting to the extent that we did in 2020. You're right what Carter and Baker said, and I think it was 2006. But I can just tell you from international experience, what happens with mail in balloting, sort of mass mail in balloting, is that you lose control of the chain of custody. So we circle back to what I started with. You know, maintaining a tight chain of custody is important. The Brennan Center, you know, will constantly try to gaslight the American public. And we must just push back against their nonsense and their pseudo research, because they actually don't advance evidence.
Well, that's right. In fact, in one of the questions that was put to this fellow by the NPR host this morning, essentially to address the sorts of things that are being recommended by him and others to advance voting rights. And he went off on a tear about Jim Crow laws and those. He didn't mention that they were all Democrats, by the way, but those senators in the South who were trying to deny people the vote in the past. But Ken Blackwell, you can attest as better as anybody how far we've come since then.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's funny. And I would just suggest that your listeners go to our website at the American First Policy Institute and take a look at a statement that I did with Dr. Albeda King, the niece of Dr. King. We pushed back against Biden and Harris and their speeches in Atlanta, Georgia recently, which in fact dealt with hyperbole and this divisive rhetoric of the left. Dr. King said in the mid-60s in the book, Chaos or Community, that's our choice. You know, do we choose chaos? And I can tell you right now, the Biden administration has chosen it with its advocacy of critical race theory, with its, you know, attempt to gaslight the American public and believe that we're having them believe that we're stuck in the 1960s. When in fact, what Lincoln said and Dr. King embraced was that we were not a perfect union, but we were a perfectible union, and that history is a process, not a snapshot. And through human agency and communal work as a nation state, we can move us, and we have moved us to much better places and made us a much fairer and open a constitutional a republic. This is something I will just say to you. We, in fact, must understand that great nations are not the products of great government. Great nations are the products of good people doing great things together. E pluribus unum, from the many one. And we are one because we all, as a country, we recognize, our founders, framers of our Constitution, recognize that our rights are not grants from government. They're gifts from God.
Well said, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for that. We have to leave it at that for the moment. Mr. Ambassador, come back to us again with updates very soon. I think there's some very good news in what you've shared with us, and obviously some very important insights as well. Thank you for taking the time to do it. Godspeed, my friend.
Thank you, Frank.
Next up, Captain Jim Fennell about China, the threat poses to all of us, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we are joined by one of my favorite guests. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, and who served in the uniform of the United States Navy with great distinction in its intelligence branch, working specifically for much of his distinguished career in the Western Pacific on, not surprisingly, the China threat. He understands it better than just about anybody. He has done more to raise alarms about what is emerging and now is upon us than just about anybody. And the chance to take stock with him and to appreciate really how serious the dangers are at the moment is a great privilege, and one of the things that I know our audience very much appreciates, as do I. Jim is, among other things, a member of the Committee on the Present Danger China, for which we are very grateful. And we're always delighted, as I say, to have him with us. Captain, Happy New Year to you. Against all odds, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks. Great to be with you. Happy New Year.
I wanted to sort of just take stock with you at the beginning of 2022, a year in which it seems to me there's a distinct possibility that our naval forces and perhaps other elements of our military and country, for that matter, may be in a kinetic fight with the Chinese Communist Party's People's Liberation Army, and specifically its People's Liberation Army Navy, PLAN, as it's been called. Give us a net assessment, if you would, Jim, as to where we are at the moment in terms of the build-up and build-out of the capabilities of the PLAN.
Well, Frank, the PRC has been on a naval and military modernization, but specifically a naval modernization program for the last two decades, a 20-year build rate that essentially has been outproducing the United States, not only in the number of warships, but also in tonnage in the last 7 years, outproduced us in tonnage, and then is outproducing us in what I think is the most important metric, which is anti-ship cruise missiles. I know that there's been some work done by others talking about total battle force weapon systems, but in terms of anti-ship cruise missiles that allow ships at sea in the middle of the Pacific to be able to engage each other in a combat environment, the PRC has more anti-ship cruise missiles of longer range, of a supersonic speed, where most of ours are still subsonic, and they're very difficult missiles for us to get into. So in boxing terms, the Chinese have a longer reach, a more powerful punch, and they got more punches to throw than we do. And their Navy now is... Go ahead.
Just to drill down on that for a moment, you've emphasized the term cruise missiles. You're not talking about anti-ship ballistic missiles. How serious a problem do you regard that to be?
Yeah, so the anti-ship cruise missiles are missiles that are being deployed from ships, submarines, and aircraft. The anti-ship ballistic missiles are produced and employed by the PRC's PLA rocket force. And their rocket forces have essentially two kinds of missiles that have been designed specifically to sink our carriers and large deck amphibious ships and large command and control ships like the Blue Ridge, the 7th Fleet command ship. And those are the DF-21D. And then there's this follow-on, which is essentially a double range of the DF-21D, which is the DF-26. The DF-21D can range well past the first island chain, past the Ryukyu Islands, past Okinawa. So our base is there, and anytime the U.S. carrier would operate in the vicinity of Okinawa, which is where we normally train, is covered. And then the DF-26 gives them carrier coverage out to and past Guam. So Guam is one of our, you know, besides the base that we have in Yokosuka, co-located with the Japanese, and our Marine forces down in Okinawa and Sasebo, we also have, you know, a large presence of naval forces in Guam at any one time or another, either to be refueled, refitted, transiting through, and a place for our naval forces to take respite and resources. So that would be under the range of the DF-21 or DF-26. There is a variant of that can attack the airfield there, so the air forces on Guam are also at risk. But in terms of ballistic missiles, that's the variants that are designed to essentially take out the key element of the U.S. Navy, which is our carrier fleet.
So that, Jim, you mentioned the Blue Ridge. You served on that ship, as I recall. Among other things, you were the chief of intelligence for the Pacific Fleet. You have watched this steady progression, and I know that you've also been looking at other capabilities that have been coming along in the Chinese Navy as well. And I'd just ask you to touch on, for example, the undersea capabilities, some of which I'm told may have artificial intelligence-enabled swarming feature to them, something we've not confronted in the past. Also, you know, surface vessels or drones that have similar kinds of capabilities. How serious a problem do you think those sort of emerging technologies represent in all of this, Jim?
Well, I think the what we see from the PRC Central Military Commission and in the naval arena is this kind of totality of approach to warfare. And so, you know, the Chinese 20 years ago spent a lot of effort building up their submarine fleet, and then they moved into some of their amphibious ships, and then they moved into the destroyer and frigates modernization, and then they started on the carrier program. The carrier program had been around for years, but it had been kind of put on a back burner, but it's moving out and not just buying and, you know, purchasing a carrier from the Ukraine, but building their own indigenous carriers to be escorted with the Type 055, a Renhai class cruiser with 112 vertical launch system cells to launch cruise anti-ship cruise missiles or to launch, you know, anti-air missiles and things of that nature. So they've built these carrier strike groups now and amphibious strike groups or expeditionary strike groups. The cores of those are being built out as we speak, right? So the PRC is, you know, now moving into the unmanned vehicles program, and they've got programs that are using surface ships. They're using programs that have underwater, undersea, autonomous vehicles, wave gliders, things of that nature. So in a way, they've adopted and they've investigated everything that the U.S. Navy has done, but they've not just investigated, they seem to have accelerated past us. Because they're pouring so much money into this, and their return on the investment for their dollars that they spend or their yuan that they spend is so much greater than we are, that they're seemingly able to advance beyond us in the development, not just the research that which they've stolen from us, but now they're able to develop these things and to use different tactics and techniques and procedures to maintain, you know, and have their own sea control. Certainly of the waters inside the first island chain, and they're seeking to have that capability out through the second island chain. And eventually, globally, by 2049, they want to be able to be the dominant naval power on the globe and have the ability to control the seas at their demand with the systems that they built.
It seems to me this is likely to be something they achieve well before 2049. I know that's the stated goal, and I know your writings and testimony and analysis indicates that there's a decade of particular concern, which we are now in, as I recall, that may mean that dominance is not only established, but exercised. And that brings me to something that I wanted to get at in terms of, as I say, a net assessment of the U.S. Navy at the moment, and I know what your service is one in which you take understandable pride, but you are also very clear-eyed about the challenges that it is facing at the moment, not just from formidable enemies like the Chinese Communist Party, but also in terms of its readiness, the condition of the ships, the numbers of ships, the low level of ship building output, and perhaps as well the morale of the men and women who serve on those ships. Talk a bit about sort of how you see the United States Navy measuring up against this sort of formidable capability you've just described emanating from the People's Liberation Army Navy.
Well, Frank, this week is the Navy's holding their Service Navy Association meetings in Crystal City there in D.C., and we got reporting last night that the head of Fleet Forces Command, Admiral Daryl Cottle, made a statement saying, you know, we can't just build ships that don't have the right equipment and don't have people. And we've been in a malaise inside the U.S., partly because we've been focused on the Middle East, but we haven't been surrounded by people that say they want to build up our Navy. And we keep getting, you know, efforts to do more with less. While the Chinese continue this juggernaut of construction, for instance, in 2021, the Chinese built two Type 075 helicopter carriers, which are about 40,000 tons apiece, three Type 055 destroyers, which are about 13,000, 15,000 tons apiece, seven Type 052 destroyers, each of those is 10,000 tons apiece, nine Corvette Type 056 Alphas, and one SSBN Type 094. So they built 22 naval, correct, can shoot ICBMs, nuclear-tipped ICBMs at America. They built 22 naval power projection vessels in 2021. They commissioned, and we commissioned just three, one destroyer and two LCSs. So
and that's those literal combat ships, not exactly what the times require.
No, and even if you take the nine Zhonghu frigate or corvettes that the Chinese built, those frigates that are similar in size to our LCS, they have anti-ship cruise missiles, our LCS don't. So in every way, they're outbuilding this, and they've been doing this for almost a decade in terms of, it used to be, I would tell people it was 5-1, 4-1. For every one ship the U.S. Navy produced, the Chinese would produce four or five, while spending a third of what we're spending, oh, by the way. And then now this year in 2021, it's 7-1. So we cannot sustain this and expect to be having the same kinds of international influence in the Indo-Pacific, and certainly not deterring the PRC's aggressive campaign to essentially, as we believe, both of us, that, you know, an invasion of Taiwan could be very imminent. So the balance of power has definitely shifted in 20 years. And our Navy is comprised of leaders, both civilian and uniform, that do not seem to be intent upon growing our Navy. Even, you know, respected folks like former OSD official Bob Work has written something in the U.S. Naval Institute proceedings in the last month that says we got to get away from this idea that we're going to have four deployment presence in this large Navy, and we have to scale back, and we have to, you know, get smaller ships and distributed networks and all kind of things that are in some sense, they're good. I'm not criticizing them, but we have nobody that's a champion for a big fleet, which means big numbers of people, a big recruiting drive that one was led by Ronald Reagan and John Lehman during the 600-ship Navy that I joined in the mid-80s. We're not doing that as a nation, and we're instead focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion seminars and writing content.
Let me ask you two things quickly before we have to let you go, Captain James Fennell. One is, what role does space play in the Chinese Navy's planning, power projection, and tension to defeat our naval forces?
Space is absolutely a critical element of the PRC Navy, first from just the geopositioning and timing kinds of issues with their creation of their own GPS system called Beidou, which is now a global system that is on par and rivals the U.S. GPS and the Russian Glasnost. So they have their own system whereby, if they took out GPS, which we said they never would do, if they were to do that, and now they apparently have maybe tools that could help them do that in space already, that they would then be able to operate their systems, their over-the-horizon weapon systems, with their synchronization with their satellites to collect intelligence, ground-based intelligence collection, undersea-based intelligence collection, shipboard and aircraft-based intelligence platforms, and synchronize that all together to put targeting information into an anti-ship cruise missile or an anti-ship ballistic missile that would be able to still target our aircraft carriers or surface ships or submarines, while our ships and would be essentially blind. So space is critical to the PLA and the PLA Navy and their system of networking. And they're practicing fighting in environments where they take it away from the enemy, but while they're also degraded, they're not just sitting active thinking that they'll always have access. They're practicing to be blind as well, but they're certainly going to try to make us blind.
This is a huge insight to what we're up against, and I so appreciate you explaining that in detail. Let me ask you about one last thing. The Chinese are pursuing, as you know, Captain Fennell, a very aggressive, literally global build-out of another kind, namely of infrastructure, including ports and rail systems and road systems and airports and so on, but particularly ports, a number of them in very strategic places. We've been following, with the help of a former first vice president of Peru, Francisco Tudela, active build out at the moment of one megaport on the west coast in the Pacific of Peru, and another of these ports that is apparently in the planning stages at the moment, both of which, in addition to being able to handle large volumes of super max shipping that we're familiar with in the container space, dominated by the Chinese Communist Party, of course, but also quite possibly those carrier strike groups of which you spoke a moment ago. What would be the implications if the Chinese are able to operate those groups from places like Peru in the southern Pacific, but with the ability to project power up towards the canal and into the northern Pacific in ways that would be very much, you know, inside our wire, if you will?
Yeah, Frank, I think what we see is the Chinese building. It's like if you're watching somebody build a building, a big building or a big skyscraper, they have been pouring concrete into a foundation around the world that they're building now superstructure on, if you will, that will allow them to erect this great behemoth. And so what the Chinese are doing in these ports, we heard about, you know, last month, the west coast of Africa and Equatorial Guinea, a similar kind of report. They're everywhere. And we don't really have a really full understanding. I think we have a lot of the bits and pieces, but we haven't really put it together and informed the rest of the American people, let alone even Congress, that what China's doing and the Navy that they're building and the infrastructure that they're developing and the contacts and the diplomacy that they get from access will, in maybe in a light switch, give China the ability to have what people condemn the United States for having is 700 bases around the world. Now, I'm not suggesting that China's going to have 700 bases, but they're building the structure and they're making the contacts and they're working their way in to be able to have that capability. And once they start operating globally, you know, people scoffed at that 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, but not so much now. And so
next up, we're going to speak with Dr. Stephen Blank about another flashpoint in the world, Ukraine, what the Russians have in mind, what we're doing about that problem right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is Dr. Stephen Blank. He is one of our country's foremost experts on a country that we talk a lot about, but frankly, we don't study as closely as we used to and as we should. He has done a lifetime's worth of studying on first the Soviet Union and then the Russian Federation. He's deeply knowledgeable about Vladimir Putin, a man who has dominated the place basically since the fall of the USSR. He has been one of our most impactful academics, teaching our military personnel, specifically the United States Army, at its war college for many decades. He has of late been involved in associations with other think tanks, including now the Foreign Policy Research Institute, Philadelphia. He is a man of great acumen about the sorts of things we are particularly worrying about at the moment. Specifically, what is Vladimir Putin up to with respect to the threats that he is clearly wanting us to perceive to Ukraine, and that have triggered a whole series of responses by the United States, by NATO, by the Organization of Economic for Economic Cooperation, what is it, and Development, yeah, and in other ways as well, diplomatic and intelligence and so on. And we're anxious to catch up with him to take stock. So, Steve Blank, thank you, and welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We haven't talked with you in a while. Happy New Year to you. I pray it will be.
I hope so.
So, give us just a 30,000-foot level assessment of, well, what's going on, and why is it going on at Vladimir Putin's instigation?
Well, okay, first of all, this is a completely fabricated and unprovoked crisis. Nobody is threatening Russia. Yet the Russian government insists on this because it is structurally set up to give its leadership the worst case threat assessment, because intelligence and military people know that's what they want. Second, they are incentivized to do this because they get more power, budget, and staff, etc. And third, Putin wants to hear it because he believes it to begin with. Second, this is also...
And when you say believes it, it believes that NATO is threatening Russia?
Right. And for 25 years or more, they've been propagandizing this. So they believe their own propaganda also, that Russia is being threatened because it's not being allowed to be a great power and so on. What is really at stake here is this. The logic of the Russian system, which is an autocracy, a classic Muscovite autocracy, is empire. Empire is not possible unless Russia owns Ukraine. Ukraine is sliding away from Russia. It is not following the Russian script. Its people have become quite anti-Russian. The government is not negotiating with Russia, is not knuckling under. And what's more, Putin sees covertly, because of this crazy threat assessment, that NATO is coming into Ukraine, although nobody in NATO wanted Ukraine as a member. And as a result, he has started this crisis and trying to overthrow the settlement of the 1990s in order to establish not only a renewed version of the Russian Empire, not Soviet, but just Russian, and second, in order to maintain his domestic popularity and system at home, because that also is failing in popular opinion, and he has nothing to offer the Russian people but basically imperial adventures. If you remember the old phrase about the Roman Caesars, that as they could stay in power as long as they offered the public bread and circuses. Putin can't offer bread, but he can try to offer an imperial circus. Unfortunately, this one is going to be a war unless he backs down, because there's nowhere for NATO to go here. And NATO is not going to surrender to him, neither will Ukraine.
Well, you've set the table for a very rich conversation. Let's parse out some of the things that you've just talked about. The sentiment that Vladimir Putin has expressed repeatedly over these decades in power is that the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century was the collapse of the Soviet Union, or more to the point, its destruction at the hands of those horrible NATO allies.
Well, but that's
is
not
that
true.
Informing this? Of course, it's not true. But I'm just saying, is that informing this aspiration? Is it not just wanting to have empire? Is it not just wanting to give his people circuses? Is it, you know, about getting even in part? And does that catalyze into war, do you think, at this juncture?
Yeah, it is about getting even. Putin is a man who has said that Russia was the Soviet Union, which is nonsense. You know, Russia was one of 16 component republics within the Soviet Union. They had a very complex constitutional structure. We don't have time for that. But Russia was not the Soviet Union, although to Russian chauvinists like Putin, it was, because it's the empire. And what he mourns is not the Soviet aspect of it. He's not interested in socialism, but the union, the empire, is what drives him. And he's determined to get it back, because that's the only way he can prove to everybody, not least China, by the way, that Russia really is a great power that deserves to be heard in, you know, on the executive board of world politics.
You mentioned that he's interested in establishing a Russian empire, not Soviet. So again, he has perhaps got a blind spot for some of these places, but not for Ukraine. He certainly sees it as a cornerstone of that empire, does he not? And therefore, this is not, as some would have us believe, idle posturing by him, or seeing what he could get sort of diplomatically from, there's much higher stakes, are there not, Steve Blank?
Well, first of all, it's not idle posturing. Second, it is an article of faith among Russian nationalists that Ukraine is Russia. Kiev, the Russian state originated in Kiev. We call medieval Russia Kiev in Rus. That's the technical term for it. And Kiev is called the mother of Russian cities. So they believe that Ukraine is really Russia. And its secession, if you like, from the Russian state negates the whole narrative by which Moscow is the legitimate heir to the Russian state. Second, the threat is not to Russia. There's nobody threatening Russian people, Russian lands, or anything. The threat is to Vladimir Putin and his system of kleptocracy and a mafia-like government. And that's what the real threat is, because Ukraine is striving to build democracy. And a democratic Ukraine that looks west is anathema to Putin. The same thing, to a lesser degree, we saw in Kazakhstan, where people were, you know, autonomously acting in politics. Again, this is anathema to these guys. And as a result, the only answer they have is force. And they're mobilizing the force. Now, if they got a diplomatic victory without having to fire a shot, as you and I and your audience would understand, that's great. You know, okay, but NATO said no, and the Biden administration has done quite well. It has held the alliance together, which is not easy, and it has been quite staunch. What needs to happen now, I think, is that NATO has to put some teeth into this and start telling Putin, if you start a war in Ukraine, you will have to deal with us. We will make it impossible for you to win, and it'll be the last war you ever fight. Period. End of story.
What do you think NATO is actually saying to Putin at the moment? It seems to me, Steve, that it doesn't have much to do with that kinetic set of threats. It's economic and political, perhaps diplomatic. Am I right about that?
Right. You're absolutely right. It doesn't have a lot to do with the kinetic threat. But we're past the point where I think, you know, the economic threats, which are quite powerful, by the way, much more powerful than people imagine, are going to suffice to change his equation. This is a man who will only yield to superior force, and and not just physical force, but moral force. And that has to be demonstrated in behavior. And that's what needs to happen.
Do you see any evidence, Steve, at the moment, that anybody in NATO, let alone NATO as an organization, and most especially the United States under Joe Biden, is disposed to backing up with tangible evidence of a will to use force to resist this threat from Russia? Or is it a hollow sort of character, if you will, of a countervailing force?
At the moment, I don't see anybody willing to use their own forces. I do see that there is mounting desire to support Ukraine by funneling or channeling forces, weapons, and support to Ukraine. I think, though, that by, you know, if we had put more forces on the border of NATO with Belarus and Russia and Belarus and in the Baltic states, and made it clear that we would not stand by idly if Ukraine is attacked, that this would have had a salutary effect on them.
We didn't do that. And in fact, what seems to be in play at the moment is a negotiation over whether we will reduce what's there, minimal though it might be. So it seems as though it's moving in the wrong direction on that regard.
That was a fake article. You know, you've been in government. People leak things for one or another motive. That article was a leak designed to embarrass the administration, and it's not true. I mean, I've spoken to people in the administration. There is no desire to reduce conventional forces in Europe, and there's few of them.
Let me ask you about this, Steve, because again, you've been inside the heads of these guys for a long time, Putin most especially, but you know, sort of his entourage. Surely they have been perceiving. And I gather, I think in our last conversation, you were rather forthright about this. They're holding in low regard Joe Biden, even before the Afghan debacle. But the question has been, when they hear Biden talking as he did in the call with Putin, it's been 3-4 weeks ago, I guess now, about accommodating Putin and the like, do you think that that's being perceived by Moscow, by the Kremlin, is anything other than a weak and irresolute West that, whether it's said or not, can probably be pressed to make concessions of the kind that you say are in a false story?
Well, they believe the West is irresolute and weak and can be pressured or won't do anything sufficient to stop them. But you're wrong about Biden. I mean, the administration has been very good on this. And I think Biden was pretty tough with Vladimir Putin. The problem is the NATO alliance, our allies in Europe, are not willing to step, you know, have been living in a fool's paradise. I mean, I feel very frustrated about this. I've been warning about Putin since he came in. And the fact is that what Putin is now demanding is what Yeltsin was wanted also, just did not have the power to do it. But if you go back to Yeltsin and his diplomacy, he's telling Bill Clinton, and we have the papers, that the Europe ought to be organized along lines of a Russo-American spheres of influence. And that's 95, 96.
It's I guess, standard procedure for the Russians to want to have something akin to that kind of sphere of influence that they used to have. Where does this go from here? If, as you say, Putin, for his own domestic reasons, needs to be seen as successfully bullying the West, and the West seems to be willing to stand up to Putin, but not forcibly, with the possible exception, as you say, of supporting Ukrainians in their military capabilities. And I did want to say, let me just digress for 1 second before putting that question to you a completed way. A colleague of ours, Phil Carber, who runs the Potomac Institute, has spent a lot of time with and in the Ukrainian theater and has written an interesting, rather has been interviewed recently, a piece that appeared 1945.com, an online resource. And he says that there's been a miraculous transformation of the Ukrainian military, and that if it were able to fight sort of a set-piece battle with the Russians in the sector that they've heavily defended, it would be a difficult thing for the Russians to succeed. But he points out that the Russians could bring to bear on a multi-front sort of operation basis a lot of capabilities the Ukrainians can't match, nor, I assume, would they be able to, even if NATO were willing to step up more to support them than it has to this point. So talk us through what Phil is saying there and the possibilities that this would end very badly.
Well, I think you summed it up quite well. If we were to have a set-piece battle, it would be a very difficult battle. But the Russians are mobilizing forces and weapons so that they can outflank and circle the Ukrainian front. Putin cannot afford to fight a protracted war. We know this from Russian history. Protracted war is the supreme test of the viability of the state, and fairly often it is collapsed, like World War I. But the fact of the matter is that if we can give Ukraine the means to prolong, protract, and resist, this will go badly for Putin. The problem is there's no strategy in the West for dealing with Russia in this way. There's no information war that we're doing against Russia, even though Putin's been launching information warfare against this country for at least a decade. There's no real offensive plan that I see for dealing with Russia in a wartime situation.
So, Steve, if I could just ask you to sort of conclude this interview with your crystal ball assessment of where does this go from here? There are limitations on what NATO's prepared to do. There's some constraints on Putin. What is the book you're making at the moment?
All right. The limitations on NATO are self-imposed. The constraints on Putin, on what Russia is able to sustain, are more objective in nature. I'm afraid that Putin is going to, as they say in French, va-banque, go to the bank and try and force Ukraine, literally, to give him what he wants.
Through military war. Action.
War, yeah. It's a French phrase called force majeure, you know, direct force, major force. The Russians were never interested in serious diplomacy. They launched ultimatums. All this talk about all the propaganda they've made about it, about not being satisfied. These are people who won't take yes for an agreement.
Yeah. We will be following this, needless to say, closely, and I hope with your good help. Thank you, Steve, for your time today, as well as your cumulative service to our country on these and money-related issues. It's been indispensable, and look forward to talking with you often in 2022. Stay well, my friend. Thank you for listening, folks. I hope that you've found this helpful. We'll be talking with you again on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.